This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Break Shot, written and performed by me, James Taylor. I'm James Taylor, and I'm a professional autobiographer. I usually talk about myself with a guitar in my hand, and actually, I have one here in case I need it. For the next 90 minutes or so, I'm going to take you on a tour of my early life, the source of many of my songs. What happened to me before anybody knew my name? I'm in the barn of my property in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts. My wife, Kim, is up in the house. Our twin sons, Rufus and Henry, are back at high school in Boston for their senior year. The place is quieted down a little. There's a fire in the wood stove. Autumn is in the air. It's a natural time to reminisce. Perhaps art happens when the usual channels are not available and we have to find a new path forward. Sometimes in describing that new pathway, we open a door that is useful to other people too. My story is entwined with the story of my family. The Taylors have enjoyed many blessings and a good deal of real pain. My parents are gone, so I feel I can talk about them openly. My older brother, Alex, too. My sister, Kate, and my brothers, Livingston and Hugh, on the other hand, are still with us and going strong. So I'm going to do my best to leave them out of this recollection. They have their own versions of what happened to us and their own stories to tell. I have made a living of putting my business in the street. That may be good or bad. I suppose I am telling this story mostly to myself. Thank God it's not compulsory listening. You can tune me out at any time. I took a walk in the woods the other day and tried to think of a title for this recollection. I thought maybe Break Shot, the opening of a game of pool when you slam the cue ball into the 15 other balls and they all go flying off. Growing up, my family had every advantage. We were white and privileged. My father was president of his class at Harvard Medical 4 years in a row, a prominent professor, dean of the University of North Carolina Medical School. My mother was from Massachusetts. Her father was a fisherman. She went to finishing school, studied voice at the New England Conservatory of Music. She did everything well. She designed our house. She painted. She raised sheep and wove her own cloth. She designed and planted beautiful gardens. We grew up in North Carolina, taking classical music lessons, going to concerts by Andre Segovia and Pablo Casals. We traveled to Europe by steamship and vacationed in the Caribbean. As a kid, I acted in a small theater group. Every summer, we drove up to Martha's Vineyard and spent idyllic weeks by the seashore. That's where we learned to sail. We took regular train trips to New York to see the theater and visit museums. By the time I was 15, I could speak French, and I had 4 years of cello under my belt. I spent one summer at an Audubon camp where we studied natural science. At 16, I went on an international friends trip to the Soviet Union. We were given a lot. But somehow, in the 60s, our family fell apart. 3 of us kids ended up in psychiatric hospitals, and a 4th should have. Drug and alcohol addiction tore us up. You could make a case that most of the songs I have written have been a way of trying to work out just what happened to us. It's like that movie Groundhog Day. I am assigned to keep going through it over and over until I figure it out, until I get it right. They say the child is father to the man. The child in this man has been father to a lot of music.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, God bless the child that's got his own. So the strong get more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't seem to make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
My father, Isaac Taylor, Ike, met my mother, Gertrude Woodard, Trudy, at a party in Boston in 1944. He was tall, charismatic, and projected confidence. She is said to have told her friends that she knew right away she wanted to have his children. The war was on, but my father had received a deferment to continue his medical studies. The U.S. military knew he would be of more value to them later as a physician. I was born at the Boston Lying-In Hospital in March of 1948 and spent my early childhood in Weston, out in the suburbs. When I was small, my father was a research fellow at Harvard and chief resident at Massachusetts General Hospital. My brothers, my sister, and I were born into a post-war Boston family. We were brought up to be devoted to progressive politics, self-improvement, and the arts. When I was about four, my dad accepted a job at the University of North Carolina and moved the whole family south, back to where he was from. I don't think my mother ever got over the shock. From that point on, Massachusetts became our lost Eden. Every summer, my folks loaded all five Taylor kids into the family station wagon and hauled us up to Martha's Vineyard in an effort to restore our Yankee credentials. My mother ultimately won the battle for the hearts and minds of her children. Kim and I lived between the Berkshires and Boston, just as it says in the song. Our boys even elected to go to the same private school in Massachusetts that I reluctantly attended. Memory is tricky. We remember how it felt, not necessarily how it was. Songs grow out of memories. I have a running joke that I keep writing the same six or seven songs over and over again. I think many of us keep trying to work out exactly what happened in our early years. We want to go back and fix something that has already vanished and can never be corrected. But we can correct it in a song, in a book, in a poem, in a play. One of the nice things art does is to make things rhyme, to tie up loose ends. Sometimes you can even slap on a happy ending. My mom had five children in 7 years. She worried that raising her kids in North Carolina would turn them into hillbillies. The South in the 50s was fighting the last battle of the Civil War, the fight to maintain segregation. Trudy jumped right into the civil rights movement. She picketed segregated lunch counters. She led an effort to integrate the University of North Carolina faculty club. Dad was trying to raise money to build a medical school, and I think the public nature of his wife's political activities made him uneasy. Not that he didn't believe in everything she did. He was a committed progressive, and his work at the university was helping to build a liberal oasis in Jesse Helms's South. But I think he was sensitive to the political tensions it created for his wife to be out in the street protesting. As a kid, I was very influenced by my parents' record collection. Harry Belafonte, Nina Simone's Little Girl Blue, Guys and Dolls, Oklahoma, Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. Dad's favorite, Lead Belly. Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland had a big effect on my harmonic sense. A big record in the Taylor House was the cast recording of South Pacific. There was a song in that show that summed up my mother's attitude towards the bigotry she was set against.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late. Before you are 6 or 7 or 8. To hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
When we arrived in North Carolina, we moved into a rented farmhouse. But before long, my folks bought a piece of land down on Morgan Creek, on the south side of town. My mother began working with an architect to design and build a beautiful house, a work of art, really. Trudy expressed herself in everything she did. We were kind of isolated out there. As kids, we seemed to have hours of empty time, time to daydream, to lie in the grass and stare at the clouds passing by, a reverie, a dream, a fantasy could last all afternoon. I don't think I would have become a songwriter if I had not had all of those free days to let my imagination roam. My brothers and I camped out. We fished. We shot BB guns. We spent days roaming the woods. We chopped down trees with axes and made forts, and we fought with other kids to protect our territory. My parents were united in establishing a home and raising the children in the Carolinas. It felt like our family had made the transition from north to south pretty well. We were settling in. Then Uncle Sam came calling. In early 1955, the bill on my father's military deferment came due. Ike reported to the Navy and was assigned to the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. He commuted home to North Carolina on weekends, but he was miserable. He hated his duties at Bethesda. Ike had always been fascinated by the polar explorers, Ernest Shackleton, Roald Amundsen. He admired their fortitude and perseverance against nature. He became aware that the Navy was recruiting volunteers for a 2-year expedition to build a scientific base at McMurdo Sound in Antarctica. He put in to be medical officer for 100 Navy CBs at the South Pole. Our family's history falls to either side of that decision. Having brought my mother south, Ike left her alone for 2 years with 5 kids in the beautiful house she had designed, while he vanished to the bottom of the world. Trudy felt displaced and abandoned. It was very difficult for her. She longed for New England. She yearned for the seashore where she had grown up. She became depressed. Alex, the oldest child, bore the brunt of our mother's frustration. He acted out. He got in trouble at school. He felt forced out of the family and looked for a community among his friends. I think Alex began to symbolize to Trudy the bad things about the South and about her relationship with her husband. Alex and my mother had fierce battles. They did not fight like parent and child. They fought like equals. It was frightening to see. It was a point of pride to my mother that her children did not speak with Southern accents. Alex was the only one of us who did. Alex spoke with a Southern accent until the day he died. Alex brought home records, Yes Indeed by Ray Charles, Jackie Wilson, Don Covey, Joe Tex, Fontella Bass, Carla, Rufus, and Irma Thomas, Chitlin Circuit R&B acts, beach music. Alex took root in the South. During the time when my dad was away and Mom and Alex were at war, I was very concerned with keeping our lifeboat afloat. I became conscientious about making sure that Trudy's mental state was okay. I did well in school. I tried to behave. I paid a lot of attention to whether my mother was happy. I was a good son. I look back on it now, it occurs to me that children need to know that they are not the ones responsible for their parents' emotional well-being. There was no communication from my father, only large packets of letters, all numbered, that came in the mail from time to time. There would be a letter to open for each child's birthday. He became a distant figure to us, almost imaginary. In Antarctica, Ike had the key to the liquor locker for 100 men. When he finally came home after 2 years at the South Pole, he came back with a serious drinking problem. Ike later told me that he had his first taste of alcohol when he was a freshman in college at UNC, and he felt like he had found the key to his happiness. That's what addicts say about their first drink, their first line of cocaine, their first snort of heroin. It's like you have found the key that fits your personal lock. My mother had been running the house and family without Ike for 2 years. She was not going to hand him back the helm. If the kids had thought that everything would be better when Dad got home, we were in for a disappointment. For all civilized history, fathers have gone away. A father could be in the merchant marine or a sailor on a ship and be gone for 2 years. Now, you can construct a usable father out of relatively little material, but a mother has to be there. Ike Taylor had a limited vocabulary for expressing love or tenderness. It probably caused him considerable pain and left his children with issues each would have to wrestle with. My father had a tragic childhood. His mother died giving him birth. That sounds about as bad as things can get, but it was worse. My grandfather, Alexander Taylor II, was a North Carolinian who married a college friend of his sister. Theodosia Haynes was from a prominent family in Springfield, Massachusetts. She and Alexander fell for each other and were quickly married. When Theodosia became pregnant carrying my father, she asked that her father-in-law deliver the baby. Old Dr. Taylor had not delivered a baby in years. He botched the birth. My father was born safe, but my grandmother got an infection and died within 2 weeks. The old doctor was dead soon after. Whether it was suicide, we don't know. He had killed his son's young wife, and then himself. It It shattered the family. My grandfather could not deal with the baby. He gave my father to his sister and her husband to raise. My father grew up in a state of original sin, of assumed blame. He was brought up in a house across a broad lawn from the home where his father lived, an outsider in his own life. The Taylor family were doctors and lawyers. They owned a sanitarium across the street from those two large homes. Broad Oaks was an asylum from the antebellum South. The air smelled of soft coal. There were rhododendrons. It had a very specific and very southern feel to it. When Ike was about 7, he was sent away to a boarding school. My father excelled at academics. He completed pre-med at UNC in 3 years. He was president of his class at Harvard every year he was there. He was driven by the idea that he had to earn a place in the world. His position was not guaranteed. Everything was conditional. My dad's medical school roommate enlisted in the war effort and sold Ike all his clothes. That became his uniform. 2 suits, one dark worsted wool, the other seersucker for summertime, 6 white cotton shirts, brown and black Oxford shoes. Every year he would replace 1 of the 2 suits. He would reorder the shirts, the same shoes, the same belt. Dad had lost his hair early, and he shaved his head. At the time, there were only 2 men in America with shaved heads, Yul Brynner and Ike Taylor. He was imposing-looking, a handsome guy. He had a great voice, too. He could be 100 yards away with the wind blowing, and he'd say,
"James, come here."
I could hear him as if he were standing in front of me. When he brought my mother from Massachusetts to North Carolina, Ike was repeating the tragic pattern of his parents. My father could have stayed at Mass General Hospital and started a career at the center of the academic universe. What made him drag his young family back to North Carolina, the scene of so much sadness for him? It's a mystery to me. My mother later said that, for all his intelligence and charisma, Ike lacked just enough confidence at some basic level. He felt like an outsider his entire life.
Last thing I remember is the freezing cold. Water reaching up just to swallow me whole. Ice in the rigging and howling wind. Shock to my body as we tumble in. My brothers and the others were lost at sea. I alone have returned to tell thee. Getting in ice for a century, I walk the world again. Lord, have mercy on a frozen man. Next words have been spoken to me. Nurse asked me what my name might be. She was all in white at the foot of my bed. I said, "Angel of mercy, I'm alive, Rabbi dead." My name is William James McPhee. I was born in 1823. I was raised in Liverpool by the sea. But that ain't who I am. Lord, have mercy on the frozen man. Have mercy on the frozen man.
Trudy maintained her determination to keep her children connected to the North. Every 2 or 3 months, we would go to Durham, get on the train, and come up to New York City. We would go to museums and the theater. We saw Green Willow with Anthony Perkins, Bye Bye Birdie with Dick Van Dyke, A Long Day's Journey into Night. My sister Kate and I saw My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews. On one of those trips to New York, I got my first guitar at Shermer's Music Store on Broadway. I'd been playing cello for 4 years, but I wanted to play guitar. The store had a Fender Electric, like Pop Staples played, and I wanted that, but my parents said, "No, we'll buy you a guitar, but not one of those." They got me a budget acoustic guitar with nylon strings. I switched them for steel strings as soon as I got home. My brother Alex spray-painted it blue, the fingerboard, the frets, the strings, everything. 2 years later, I would buy a Silvertone electric guitar and amp with $40 I earned washing dishes. Martha's Vineyard, an island off the coast of Cape Cod, is where the Taylor family was happiest. Every June, as soon as school was out, Trudy would drive us up the coast to Massachusetts in the family station wagon, a 2-day trip. Ike usually joined us, but if he had duties at the college, if he had to arrive late or leave early, we went as soon as we could just the same. We stayed in Chilmark on the western end of the island. It was literally a backwater, very isolated, nothing like the extension of the Hamptons that Martha's Vineyard has become today. Our cabin had no electricity. We used kerosene lamps and a gas-burning stove. We had a line to bring in water from the camp next door. All 4 of the brothers slept in pipe berths, bunks suspended from the ceiling by chains. 1 year I brought my guitar and amp and sat there for hours trying to bend a 7th chord. Finally, my dad said, "Jamie, if you play that one more time, I'm going to throw both you and that guitar out this window." Our best family friends were the people we vacationed with on the vineyard. Good and interesting people, politically very far left. We all loved it there, Mom and Dad too. Dad loved boats and fishing. We kids could stick out our thumbs and hitchhike anywhere on the island, be gone until dinner. We had a great time. My best and oldest friends to this day are people I met on Martha's Vineyard. Joel Zoss, Zach Wiesner, Jimmy Wallen from Brookline, Massachusetts, Lucy Duran, Albie Scott. Jeannie and Susie Blackmer were 2 girls I played and sang with. A great mess of kids. The community center in Chilmark ran movies a couple of times a week, as well as square dances and an open mic night where you could sing for a small, distracted audience. You could sneak off to the earthworks behind the community center with your girl or with someone else's girl. All of the boys hovered around the Lafferty girls, Susie and Martha. Martha was my age. She was very small and lovely, with big brown eyes and raven-colored hair. Her sister was 3 or 4 years older, a student at Swarthmore. We were like moths to a flame. Their mom had lost an eye and wore a black eye patch. They had a great record collection: the freewheeling Bob Dylan, Tom Rush, Rubber Soul, Rolling Stones. It was like a salon. Those connections are very important to my life. Probably the most important friend I met on Martha's Vineyard was Danny Korchmar. Cooch was from New York. He and I would hitchhike around the island, fishing, sneaking cigarettes, playing guitars. Cooch carried a knife. He was a couple of years older than me and very gifted. He was completely swept away by the blues, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Mississippi John Hurt. The blues Danny introduced me to had a huge influence on me. It really transported me. I was amazed by it. Danny and I formed a duo and started playing any place that would have us. There was a lot of folk and blues on the Vineyard. There were summer outposts of the Unicorn, Boston's major folk music room, and Club 47. I saw Tom Rush, the Queskin Jug Band, the Charles River Valley Boys, and the Simon Sisters, Lucy and Carly. I was 14 years old, and they were out of my league. After our family came apart, all five of the Taylor siblings would end up living on the Vineyard. It had been the place we were happiest. The regular journeys between Massachusetts and North Carolina reiterated the North-South split in my family. It was almost like the part of my father that was suffering was based in the South, and he gave in to that. He could not let go of it. It felt like a Faulkner novel. When I was 14, my mom took me to Durham, and I made a little recording of a song I wrote called River Roll. That was a concrete thing. I had written a song and made a record of it.
Roll, river, roll, long as you can be, longest river I've done seen, rolling to the sea. When I was a little boy, I played along her side. I built myself a raft of reeds, and on her I would ride. Singing, roll, river, roll, long as you can be, longest river I have seen, rolling to the sea.
When I was ready for high school, I entered Milton Academy in Massachusetts. It was just down the street from the house my parents had lived in when I was born, and I went sight unseen. I was lonely there. Home was a very long way away. I dreaded the emotional storm I would feel when I called home. My parents were proud of me, but by that time I suspect my father had mixed feelings about his own education and where it had delivered him in his life. And he was careful not to hurt my older brother's feelings by celebrating my success. Milton Academy had mandatory chapel. We went to church 3 times a week. I chose the Episcopal service because it was closest to my dorm. Growing up the son of a scientist, we had absolutely no church connection. My parents thought the Southern evangelicals were snake oil salesmen. But religious services at Milton introduced me to the Protestant hymnal, and that's bedrock stuff. In terms of harmonies in Western music, it's our common musical culture. It leads to a lot of Southern gospel, both white and black. I would sing a bass harmony, a middle harmony. I would experiment with where in the song to put my voice. It taught me a lot. Once to every man and nation, Jerusalem, O come, Emmanuel. Those hymns were a musical education to me. I learned them on the guitar, and they taught me all I know. I think of myself as a jealous agnostic. I don't really believe, but I envy those who do. Religion helps people think as a collective humanity. It moves us away from the prison of the isolated self, our tooth and claw. Church brings people together as a collective, and so does a concert. There's a spiritual dimension to music that has nothing to do with the lyrics. Songs have healing power. Songs help people celebrate. Songs let people commiserate. A lot of my own work has been therapeutic. It's a lucky accident that those songs have reached other people and let them know they're not alone. After 10th grade at Milton, I asked my parents if I could come home for my junior year. They said yes, but it was not what I had hoped. I'd been gone too long. I just didn't fit in anymore. What was important about that year back in North Carolina was that I joined my brother Alex's band, the Fabulous Corsairs. As far as I remember, the group was named by Vic Lipscomb, our bass player. Vic had cards made up that said, "The Fabulous Corsairs, the sound that abounds with musical style," which, if you think about it, means absolutely nothing. We played R&B, "When a Man Loves a Woman," "You Better Hold On to What You Got," "What I Say." We had a station wagon with a U-Haul behind it to tow the gear. We played fraternity parties, spring breaks, proms. We played sock hops. On the Vineyard, it had been all folk music, Dylan and Baez, Tom Rush and Eric Anderson. This was beach music, the sound of parties from Virginia down to Florida. And that's what we played. Alex was our family ambassador to the North Carolina culture. He and I made moonshine. We went to drag races and stock car races. We went to dirty movies in Durham and to state fairs. Alex was always the instigator. We lived in a sort of bubble in North Carolina. We heard the records my father and mother played and what we could get on the radio, which was Grand Ole Opry stuff mostly. Alex brought home the Coasters, Sam Cooke, the Drifters, the Impressions. Oh, wonderful stuff. But I did not fit in any better at high school in North Carolina than I had at boarding school in Massachusetts. I went back to Milton for my senior year. I had not been there long when I fell into a depression. Anytime I was not in class, I was asleep. Adolescence is difficult for so many of us. We are approaching that last quarter of the game when judgment is going to be handed out about what your life is going to be. When you're an adolescent, you find out what kind of face you get, what kind of body you're going to get, what innate talents you turn out to have. You have great urges to separate from your family, but you don't want to, but you must. When that happened to me, my family was not available. A teacher named Mr. Millett took notice and tried to help me through. In so many cases, the impulse towards teenage suicide will pass if the young person can only get through that bad stretch. You just need someone to reach out a hand. We had close family friends in Boston, the Sheldons. We would all go to the Vineyard together. They visited us in North Carolina. I romanced Phoebe Sheldon off and on. She inspired me to write a song called "Something in the Way She Moves." That song would open a lot of doors for me. While I was at Milton, Mr. Sheldon kept an eye on me. Early in my senior year, he called my parents and told them, "James needs to talk to a professional." The doctor suggested that I should be institutionalized. I left Milton in the fall of 1965 and checked into McLean, a psychiatric hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. McLean had a focus on adolescent issues and an affiliated high school where teenage patients could continue their studies while getting treatment. Sylvia Plath, Robert Lowell, and Ray Charles had all been treated at McLean's. So had John Nash, the mathematician who was the subject of the movie A Beautiful Mind. Anne Sexton taught poetry seminars at McLean before admitting herself there for observation, before committing suicide. A young woman who was at McLean in 1967 and 68, Susanna Keeson, later wrote a novel called Girl Interrupted, based on her experience. In later years, the novelist David Foster Wallace would spend a month there before he wrote Infinite Jest. Those 9 months at McLean saved my life, gave me structure, kept me in line. I'm not talking about the psychiatric treatment. That did nothing for me. What McLean did was to disconnect any expectations my family had for me. This kid is locked up in a mental hospital. I wanted to jump out of the family tree, make my escape, find my own life. McLean gave me that. It cut me loose. That I would eventually end up at the center of it all again, the family celebrity, is pretty ironic.
Yeah, just knocking around the zoo on a Thursday afternoon. Just bars on all the windows and then counting up the spoon. If I'm feeling edgy, so Chico's babe, be my slave. Watch out, she's gonna get you. But you hit me with the needles, and she thinks I'm trying to misbehave. Whoa, whoa, hey. Now the keeper's trying to cool me, says I'm bound to be alright. But I know that he can't fool me, cause I'm putting him up tight. That I can feel him getting edgy. Every time I make a sudden move, whoa, whoa, just an instant. And I can hear him celebrating when I finally open the room. Come on, baby, come on. Catch me, oh, do it to it.
We're approaching that break shot, the moment when all the balls that are neatly lined up go flying off in different directions. In the late 60s, my family fell apart. The wheels came off. We jumped the rails. My parents' marriage ended. By the time he was in his mid-40s, Ike had been drinking heavily for some decades. You get to the point where you need a certain amount of alcohol a day to keep away the DTs. The delirium tremens. The DTs are serious. Seizures, days of hallucinations, psychotic breaks. Your body can't handle the amount of alcohol it needs to be normal. And that's when the bottom falls out. I saw both my father and my brother go through it. It killed Alex. Ike was never a knee-walking, ditch-sleeping, sloppy drunk. He was a highly functional man. He managed to juggle a lot of chainsaws. Finally, he drove his freewheeling Saab off the road and broke his sternum. The steering wheel broke off the column and punched into his chest. It almost killed him. He was in his own hospital for a couple of weeks. My father was seeing other women, one of them in the neighborhood, not far from the house. Mom was done putting up with it. I don't know if it had ever been a happy marriage, but it had been focused on raising young children for a long time, going to the vineyard, summering together. It had been a strong common bond, but it started to come undone. My father was good with us when we were little kids, but he didn't know how to communicate with us when we became teenagers. He couldn't offer advice on the transition into adulthood because he had never gotten that advice himself. Ike never once expressed disappointment at my leaving school, at my not going to college, which must have been an indication of the vacuum he experienced internally. He couldn't advocate for anything he himself had done. And I suspect that, in her anger, some part of my mother was glad to see her children turning their backs on academics, on Ike's world. You would think that if you were a physician and three of your children ended up in a psychiatric hospital, you would step up with some advice. Ike probably blamed my mother. He thought, this woman's driving me crazy. I'm not surprised she drove her kids crazy. Many years later, I was in marriage counseling. The therapist suggested that perhaps my father could come to a session, as so many of my issues seemed to stem from my relationship with him. Ike came to New York City for the session. He was supportive, but he refused to accept any responsibility for any of his children's problems. He pointed the finger at Trudy. The therapist asked Ike why, if his marriage to Trudy was so bad, he had had 5 children with her. He said, "I figured childbirth killed my mother. Maybe it'll kill my wife." It was said sarcastically, as a fuck you to the therapist, but it might also have had some truth to it. Between my father's drunkenness, my mother's anger, and Alex's self-destructiveness, our entire family became suicidal in a moment, and we all ran for cover to McLean. The timing was perfect. The wreck of the Taylor family was part of a series of shocks going through American culture in the late 60s. A huge post-war population was reaching college age, all of us shaped by a series of different traumas: the threat of nuclear destruction, the assassination of the Kennedys, the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and the assassination of Dr. King. Watergate was waiting in the wings. All of that together created a terrific sense of division in the country and a rejection of old systems by the new generation. We really thought the society we had grown up in was going to change profoundly. It was a perfect storm in which to have your parents not advocate for college. After 1968,